All right. Welcome, everyone, back to another edition of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen. And today I'm excited to bring you a book that really crosses an intersection of two academic disciplines, history and education, that I'm usually interested in, and this one especially today as well. So I'd like to bring Natalia Melman Petrozella and her book, Classroom Wars, Language, Sex, and the Making of Modern Political Culture. And this is from Oxford University Press and has just been published. So we're kind of getting it right as it comes off, hot off the presses. Natalia, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you could, maybe just give our audience a little biography, a little background. How did you get into history and education? How do those two merge?
So I I was one of those kids who just loved school from, you know, as early as you can imagine. School for me was always, as it is for many children in the West, kind of my central experience of life. And I got very interested in history, probably as a high schooler even, and pursued a history major in college, and then went on to be a teacher. And I started realizing, as I kind of looked around the world, and I looked at some of the things that it looked like were problems in American education, that for me, the most fruitful questions to ask were historical questions. So I thought about going to law school, as many humanities majors do, and then pretty quickly discarded that plan and realized I wanted to pursue a doctorate in history, and specifically to look at the history of education in contemporary American society.
Okay, fantastic. And I should mention that as well, you're right now assistant professor at the New School, and we're here sitting at the New School, which is at spring break, but yeah, Definitely a great learning institution here in New York City. So if we could, let's introduce your book. How you can sort of combine this idea of bilingual education with sexual education or reproductive education, or however you want to phrase it. And how did you sort of put these two ideas together?
Absolutely. So that is the first question I always get, is why sex education and Spanish bilingual education together? These two curricula don't really seem to be things that naturally kind of have a matchup or that would be comparative. And that's true in some ways. And the reason, I'll tell you how I came to them. So basically, as I read pretty deeply in the history of American education in the kind of the post-World War II era, there was this enormous emphasis on desegregation and on the kind of the problems of race and diversity in education, but they focused almost entirely around black-white issues, right? Mm-hmm. And that is that's for good reason in many ways. I mean, desegregation in the post-Brown v. Board era is probably the most important struggle that our country has dealt with. But I started thinking, well, you know, as I came of age and the kind of when multiculturalism was becoming a watchword in American schools, and I thought, well, there are a lot of different kinds of diversity. What are other ways that struggles over diversity have kind of been hashed out? I found myself in graduate school in California at Stanford, which was very wonderful and fortuitous for many reasons. But for this particular reason, you know, California has this incredible kind of multiracial, multicultural, politically varied landscape there. And so I realized, like, started thinking about what archives were available. Well, some of the central questions that we deal with today over diversity, which is, one, the kind of Latinization of the United States. Since 1965, there's been so many Latino immigrants coming in. And two, the kind of issue of sexual diversity, whether it's sexual orientation, really. So there in California, I realized, well, these are two issues which are now nationally interesting that have been hashed out here in the schools in very deep and kind of meaningful and elaborate ways. And so that kind of drew me to look at these two, which are, yes, quite different, but which I think both kind of cast a lens on what diversity means in contemporary society.
Sure. And I think also something that I found interesting as well is that a lot of times when academics or scholars or even just, you know, general books look at this area, they're more talking about higher education. And you jump in from this from a lens of K through 12. So can you kind of talk about some of the reasons there?
Absolutely. So to me, I mean, the era that the book looks at is really from the 1960s until, you know, the early 1980s. And I mean, this is a period when young people are kind of claiming agency and authority over their own lives in many different ways, and not without a lot of controversy. So there's that already, that you have real activism happening at the K-12 level. So that in itself was something I think worth looking at. But two, I mean, to me, K-12 education is such a fascinating place to look at the kind of broader questions about what a society is valuing at a particular time. How do people very explicitly kind of negotiate and navigate these big slippery questions that are hard for historians to get their hands around? They do it in things like the public schools, in advocating for or against curricula that they think will or will not kind of produce the kind of citizens that parents and taxpayers want to produce for the future generation. So for that reason, in this era, K-12 education was just such a rich place to look. Also, I should say, from a very kind of nitty gritty sources perspective, you know, as we know, education in the United States is by definition incredibly decentralized and local, and that can make it hard to make these broad claims. California was exceptionally centralized during this period. So you had a kind of really robust educational bureaucracy. Some of the players in which were household names like Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon. And so these people, largely these guys, were hashing out these big questions about Americanism and society, largely through K-12 education policy.
Right, right. And I always like the phrase sort of, the states are the laboratory for democracy. And so, you know, California is certainly a microcosm, or maybe the leader of that a lot of times in some of the policies that move on to the national discourse as well.
Well, absolutely. So in these two issues that I looked at, that is absolutely the case. So in the case of Spanish bilingual education, so after 1965, you have many, at first in the Southwest, but you have many Spanish-speaking immigrants coming into the United States. At first, this was a regional issue. How do we deal with these people, right? And these people, in quotes, I say, were cast by many policymakers as a problem because many came over with very little education. They were sometimes migrant laborers, so it was hard to educate kids for the entire school year. And so there became this kind of urgency of how do we educate these Spanish speakers to be Americans? There also was the question of the border. People could go back and forth. So there wasn't like the transatlantic immigration of the early 20th century where there was this presumption that people would be kind of amalgamated into this so-called American melting pot. Mm-hmm. That, which was a regional problem in the 60s and early 70s, has quickly become probably the central national issue over ethnic diversity. Similarly with sex education, in this period, I mean, the sexual revolution, some of the real hotbeds of it, no pun intended, are there in California. And you also have incredible reaction to it. So there's a very big political spectrum there that I don't want to say it was a microcosm of the country at large, because California is a weird and unique place.
Right.
But it certainly highlights some of these very important themes, which would become nationally resonant within just a few years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's kind of jump in. Frame this book into two parts. The first part, language, and then the second part, sex. So maybe can we just talk about part one, and then we'll jump into part two. But can you really kind of talk about the beginnings of bilingual education? I think you kind of highlight Lyndon B. Johnson was a 1968 Bilingual Education Act.
Yeah.
Can you kind of talk about the importance of that?
Sure. So, all right. So for one, the history of bilingual education in this country is definitely beginning to be told, but doesn't have the kind of very robust history written about it yet, although there's great work out there. So assumptions is that, okay, 1968, Bilingual Education Act, this is kind of like quintessential liberal great society program, and that was kind of like the real beginning of this stuff. Now, that's not really a very nuanced reading of the Bilingual Education Act. On the one hand, sure, it's unprecedented for the government to take responsibility for linguistic minorities in that way, of course. But what I try and show is that there's this long history, which other scholars have examined, of bilingual education in the U.S. that had nothing to do with Spanish speakers, for sure. But that even in this period, The Bilingual Education Act of 1968 in some ways forestalled or cut short some much more pedagogically adventurous programs which existed beforehand and which existed, and this is like really important, I haven't seen anyone else say this, which existed really with bipartisan support. So a program that we today think of as a kind of quintessential progressive lefty liberal thing, bilingual education, I show how in the early 1960s, you had a guy like Max Rafferty, who was the superintendent of California schools and then went on to run for Republican Senate. He's known, if anyone still knows him, as this kind of arch-conservative, far-right guy. And he earned that name pretty later. In the early 1960s, before bilingual education is seen as a kind of left-wing cause, he's meeting with the Mexican Minister of Education, doing textbook exchanges, saying, I'm not kidding you, every Anglo child has as much a responsibility to learn Spanish as Spanish-speaking kids have to learn English. And he has all kinds of Republican legislators on his side as well. And so to me, that's one dimension of this kind of prehistory, which I think is really relevant, that before bilingual education became a kind of great society program, you could have this bipartisanship and this kind of wider ideological kind of spread supporting bilingual education. As well, on the ground, because of us local tradition of American schools, there were lots of kind of small programs that existed that were actually, some of them even lost money when the 1968 Act was passed. For example, what I look at in San Jose, you have Ernesto Galarza, who's one of the kind of leading bilingual education advocates in the country. He has this incredible program he's developed. He's written children's books. He's committed to engage culture and language and the families of these kids in one of the most, in a city with a huge Mexican-American population. When the Bilingual Education Act is passed, you would think, oh, this is great. Now we can elaborate these wonderful programs. No, actually, a different organization, the San Jose Bilingual Consortium, which it has a very assimilationist, very kind of bare bones approach to bilingual education, ends up getting funded. This guy, Ernesto Galarza, ends up, after a long, terrible, acrimonious battle, walking away from the cause, essentially, and being like, I'm not going to fight over this. These Washington bureaucrats think they know what worked for our kids. And that, to me, is really interesting, because there you have a kind of progressive leftist educator fed up with the federal government's support for these programs, or a putative support for these programs. So to me, that's like a very interesting twist when we think about where did these programs come from, right? Absolutely. I think the Federal Act was very important, but it's not only a watershed in the way that we think. So that's kind of a piece of that part. But the one other thing I'll say just generally about why I think bilingual education is important as part of our broader understanding of American educational history is also understanding the history of multicultural education. Almost all of our histories of multicultural education in this country really focus on race as like the primary diversity category. And they usually look at that through history instruction and civics instruction. Bilingual education is totally left out of that. Well, bilingual education was always, on some level, bilingual, bicultural education. So there's a whole piece of that that I think is really important to this story and really important to the way that multiculturalism has been or not been institutionalized in American schools.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great how you can kind of look at the different levels of how this kind of bubbled up. You know, we have the top-down approach, or we have sort of the bottom grassroots approach, and it's never just a clear cut. Well, this is from the top and this is from the bottom.
Absolutely not.
In this federal system that we have, and everything sort of mashes together haphazardly.
Oh, absolutely. It absolutely does. And you also see the way these different interest groups act sometimes at odds with one another. Like I said, the most prevalent ethnic rights struggle that we learn about is the African American freedom struggle, and as I say, for good reason. But then there can be an assumption, I think, also when one is pressed for time in teaching a survey history course, of assuming that other groups' struggles were like the same, just a little bit different. Maybe they had their particular issue. This is not the case. I mean, I came up with examples of Latino parents and activists actually being anti-desegregation because they needed a critical mass of Latino kids in a school to get bilingual education funding, right? That's very different from, that's a different set of agenda, you know?
Right, absolutely, absolutely. And so you focus on Spanish bilingual, but it was actually sort of one of the biggest cases or breakthroughs for bilingual education comes from Lau v. Nichols, I think.
Or yeah, Nichols. Yeah, 1974.
Right, and so and then that was sort of taken up as like a cause, like locally. Can you kind of maybe talk about what that sort of...
Absolutely. So I focus on Spanish-speaking bilingual education, or Spanish bilingual education, because in many ways, or in almost every way, Spanish speakers were the group that was most kind of, the linguistic minority that was most, had the biggest problems with educational attainment. So in the debates around those issues, they were kind of the most heated and the most intense about, one, what do we do about this problem? But two, what are these people doing to our culture, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested, not in just schools per se, or really at all in schools per se, but in schools' connection to the larger culture.
Right.
So the Lau v. Nichols case, which you bring up, which was the Supreme Court case, which originated in San Francisco, which in 1974 mandated a kind of federal commitment to foreign language speakers, is a fascinating kind of instance of this, where the kids that really stood to benefit the most in California from bilingual education were absolutely Spanish speakers. There's a statistic always quoted, or at that time always quoted, that 50% of Latino kids were dropping out of school by the eighth grade. I mean, that's really bad, right? Now, when Edward Steinman, who was the attorney who went to try this case, was picking a plaintiff, he chose a Chinese-American plaintiff, Kenny Kinmen Lau. He said quite baldly, because that this had to do with the court of public opinion, that there was no way, and I'm paraphrasing, that a Latino kid who was associated with kind of poor educational achievement, with laziness, with all these kind of racist assumptions about Latinos, that they would compel public sympathy.
Right.
We need to get one of those hardworking Asians, essentially. And I'm paraphrasing what he said, but
sure.
Not for nothing. In 1966 is when the New York Times first started use the term model minority to describe Asian American kids. This is already 8 years later. So there's already some kind of common understanding and assumptions about what Asian kids represent as foreigners and what Latino kids do, and they're quite different.
Okay, wow, that's another...
Yeah.
That could be a whole nother book.
I know.
Well, and I think another good aspect that's covered here is, you know, we talk about sort of the Latino voter, the Latino sort of a grouping of individuals. But you really show that this was not simply a united front. There was all sorts of different areas and interests and angles. So can you talk about sort of how that played out?
Absolutely. And so it's interesting when you asked me a little bit at the beginning about my kind of intellectual biography. So one of the things that kind of turned me on to all this was my growing awareness of the diversity within the kind of category of Latino in the United States. Myself, I actually grew up speaking Spanish, the child of a Jewish Argentine mother, which is not what anybody assumes when you hear Latino in the United States.
Right.
So there was that, right? Then I was a Spanish teacher to largely Latino kids in New York City schools. Mm-hmm. That was already a strange arrangement. But I saw the way this blanket term of Latino was meant to bring in Chilean kids who'd gone to Catholic school, Dominican and Puerto Rican kids who'd been born largely in the United States but kind of had this back and forth relationship with their home country, Mexican American kids who had a different set of citizenship issues. And then as I read more, then take, let's say, the Cubans of Florida, who are in themselves a diverse group but who have a whole different set of political, identities. So to me, I was very dissatisfied with the kind of blanket term of Latino as explaining anyone's experience. Mm-hmm. In this book, that comes up as well. So California, the largest, unsurprisingly, group of Latinos is Mexican Americans, and I focus largely on them. But then in my study of San Francisco is unique in being a city in which Mexican Americans did not in this period make up a majority of the Latino population. So there I kind of explore the way you had all of these kind of Central Americans and Mexican Americans. I found many of them finding common cause around mm-hmm. this issue of bilingual education, kind of forging this pan-Latinismo on the ground because they were so aggressed in many ways by, you know, this kind of racism and a lack of receptiveness in the schools. However, I don't want to downplay how much class played into this, because there was a whole segment of kind of South and Central Americans who mm-hmm. left San Francisco, moved to the southern suburbs, and kind of wanted to distance themselves from all this. And I think class throughout this book plays out a lot. I mean, one of the things that this book brings up that is, again, not something that I've seen in other places is a kind of reckoning with conservative Latinos who were not on board with any of this, right? So there, in a lot in Southern California are the people that I'm talking about specifically, but there were a couple of people who were very vociferous of saying that bilingual education was a fraud, right? They called themselves Americans of Mexican descent, not Mexican Americans, and really spoke out against a lot of these, a lot of these endeavors, which we associate with the ethnic rights movement of this time. Those were some sort of big figures who made themselves very public. But then you had kind of everyday people that I saw as I read so many sources, like parents writing into the New York Times saying, you know, I think it's condescending to us that you think we need a Chicano teacher to teach our children. I had a blonde-haired, blue-eyed teacher. I could learn. I went to college. And these are Mexican-American parents writing this, right? And so that to me is really fascinating. Probably the guy that I focus on the most who embodies some of these tensions is this man, Eugene Gonzalez, who I'd never heard of, who just fascinated me. He's the highest-ranking a Latino appointee in the California Department of Education, appointed by this man, Max Rafferty, who I told you had this interesting relationship to bilingual education, but became known as an arch conservative. And Gonzalez becomes sort of the front line of negotiating all these bilingual education issues. And he's, it seems to be quite torn in many ways. He's, you know, telling these radical groups, we don't need to hit people with a 2x4 anymore. Like, we need to just acknowledge, you know, Latinos are, Mexican Americans are not, are a sleeping giant that has been awakened. And so we need to reckon with them, but we don't need to riot. And you see him, especially as there's this radicalization after the Bilingual Education Act with the kind of Chicano walkouts in March of that same year. You see, Eugene Gonzalez really kind of struggling with that. And you see other people, those Republicans who supported bilingual ed, not struggling so much and being like, whoa, 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 we don't want to be involved with this program. This is radical, right? This is not what we had in mind. So I think that to me, nuancing both the kind of nuancing really the politics internal to Latinos in California to me in this period is crucial, because often they're presented as sort of undifferentiated. And I think that's a major, major misunderstanding of American history.
Absolutely. And I mean, that could even be a lesson we potentially take into today's politics, which, you know, kind of when you read this, you can see the seeds. And maybe I think that's sort of what you were sort of trying to show, maybe a trajectory or sort of this, I guess, new right, and how that sort of was fostered through a backlash of this growing, I don't know if it's a radicalization, but this movement that is a progressive thing, things like this was a, very much a pushback. And we can see the seeds today.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, historians notoriously like think backlash is not a good term to use. I agree with you in some ways that absolutely part of the story I'm trying to tell is about backlash and about sort of the more multiple seeds that generated the plant that inspired that backlash, I guess you would say, Because we haven't really, like, to me, one of the things that's just mind-boggling is that this very rich history of the new right, the kind of rise of the right literature in America, and a very rich history of Latinos in the United States, these two literatures have not met. They never meet. They have not really met at all. And to me, I was thinking, California people, this is like the fount of both of these studies, and they developed in connection with one another and affected one another, and we've got to take that seriously. So yeah, there's that piece. But another story that I'm trying to tell, and this is not just in the bilingual education story but across bilingual ed and sex ed too, is that Rise of the Right does not tell the whole story. We have a kind of persistent progressivism, which both of these programs were crucial in establishing in American schools, that continues to be vibrant, not ascendant. It's certainly contested. There's no question. But I think the contestation between right and left and lots in between really continues in American schools. So I don't think we can declare a victory of the kind of, purely conservative tendencies in American education.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, that I think it's a nice connector to the next part of your book, part two, and this is sex education. And the first line that you have is just you're quoting, I think, a parent or someone, and it says, "Is the schoolhouse the proper place to teach raw sex?" It's just like a wonderful question that I think illustrates the mindset of sort of the detractors from this kind of education. So can you kind of talk about what the environment was then? I guess that was in the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's in the middle of the 1960s. So it seems sort of inflammatory and almost laughably kind of, you know, like, oh, this, you know, sort of like guy must have hang-ups or something to say something like that. But really, I mean, the moment that they're talking about is this incredibly confusing, tumultuous political and cultural moment. So you're in the middle of the 1960s, right? You've got the Engle v. Vitale Supreme Court decision, which basically makes prayer in school not conceivable anymore. You've got a series of Supreme Court decisions which narrow the definition of obscenity as well. So think of what that means. That means that all sorts of things which before were in under brown paper bags or not uttered at all are now on billboards, on the cover of books, on so you had this kind of sense that, okay, on the one hand we can't talk about God anymore in school. And we also have like these bodice rippers being sold in the supermarket, right? Like what's happening to society?
Right.
And at the same time, you know, you have the kind of broader free speech movement, sexual revolution happening, ethnic rights movements going on. So I argue that a lot of frustrations and anxieties about these issues crystallized in the debates over sex education. So this guy, and it was a guy, is clearly, you know, anti-sex education. And he is saying, you know, is the schoolhouse the proper place to teach raw sex? Clearly, it's a rhetorical question. The answer is supposed to be absolutely not. But and he's stressed out because of all of these changes that I said were happening. What's interesting is that the creators of the sex education programs in this period, which gained new energy in this era as well, they're also stressed out about all these same things, right? Even though their detractors would place them as these kind of libertine, perverted, hippie radicals who are trying to turn their kids into sex slaves, most of the sex educators, if you really read what they're trying to do in the 1960s, are equally concerned about the sexual revolution and everything happening. They just believe we should talk about these things in order to manage adolescent sexuality. Now, that is still, at that period, a pretty radical declaration that we should talk about sexuality at school. And Janice Irvine has done amazing work on that in showing how just talking about sex in the 1960s, even to quite moderate ends. I mean, if you look at some of these sex ed curricula from this period, as I did, they tend to culminate in heterosexual marriage, right? The last lessons are about, like, managing your domestic economy as they talk about you know, kind of petting or like premarital sexual activity. It's always about kind of girls staving off like a boy's, you know, like urges. You never hear really talk about female pleasure or anything like this. This is not totally radical, you know, sexual theory or anything like that. But at the same time, talking about any of this stuff was really considered to be quite, you know, quite controversial.
Absolutely. And there was, and I guess for me, I couldn't really think of a connection, but maybe it was apparent then, but a connection to sort of the fear of communism and sexual education. I think it was highlighted in the Anaheim section.
Yeah, everybody is so surprised about that. So there were a whole series of big fights over sex education during this period in California. So as I mentioned, or maybe I didn't mention, California was this kind of seat of incredible educational innovation in this period. The whole country was looking at California. You have one of these kind of ed policy guys saying very proudly, in the 1960s, it was 3 months before an idea came out in the journals, before we had it in classrooms. Like, really, California was implementing all this new stuff. Sex ed programs were one of those. So in then as a result, there were a whole bunch of controversies in different California towns, right. Really, really intense controversies. One very intense one was in Anaheim, California, mm-hmm. which I look at. Now, in Anaheim, the thing that's really arresting about that controversy is that the parents who organized against sex education, as you mentioned, they saw it as a communist plot
right.
to, you know, undermine America, to undermine mm-hmm. their children's sense of individualism,
right.
their children's sense of patriotism. And it's kind of like, what? How does a curriculum about reproduction and, you know, anything else kind of lead to that? And
right.
so what I, and then the funny thing is, even though I read these curricula in such great detail, it became very clear that the anti-sex education people really hadn't read the curriculum,
sure.
which is sort of like the idea, right? So if you think about it, well, one, Southern California, that's Orange County in this period,
mm-hmm.
is kind of defined by the defense industry in many ways. So you have people mm-hmm. who are already very much in that kind of Cold War mindset. Even
right.
this is the mid and late 60s, so later than certainly the kind of age of, you know, McCarthyism and all that in
yep.
the 1950s. They're still very much in that Cold War mindset. They are also, many of the people who migrated there came from Los Angeles after the Watts riots, right?
Mm-hmm.
and a kind of desegregation problems in LA. So they came to kind of batten down, you know, kind of like circle the wagons, rather,
right.
around some of these changes from the outside world. So then what they saw also was, or the way that the communism thing sort of manifested, was also these ideas about what communism was supposed to be about in terms of sexuality,
right.
right? This idea that women in communist countries are sort of genderless. They go out and they work, right?
Yeah,
they are not home in their beautiful sort of suburban kitchens.
Right.
You know, they have kind of nationalized childcare. There were all these kind of stories about how they actually pass children around to share breastfeeding among different mothers. Like,
okay.
You know,
right.
marriage is sort of devalued,
yeah.
godless communism. So
right.
all these sort of ideas, right?
Okay.
And so those kind of connected to, well, what's going to happen if we start talking about sexuality and gender roles in schools? Our kids are going to turn into that,
right.
right? And so there was one sort of popular narrative which circulated, which was that one of the most controversial parts of these curricula was any talk of masturbation. And
mm-hmm.
so they said, well, they're going to tell our kids about masturbation. So our kids are just going to masturbate all day, be turned
mm-hmm.
into sex slaves, primed for communist takeover. Right. And so the idea is that by discussing
right.
sexuality, you are condoning a kind of unrestrained, sexuality that will sap children of the kind of restraint, patriotism, moralism, which was supposed to be definitive of American culture.
Right. And it's interesting, I think, a figure that comes up a lot as well is Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Who, of course, is, you know, the governor and then, you know, goes on to be sort of this conservative icon presidential candidate.
Mm-hmm.
But can you kind of maybe talk about, you know, he was always sort of this wholesome figure, I guess. So he personally was sort of very anti-sexual education, things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting. On the to the point I made before, on the bilingual education front, actually early on, Ronald Reagan is totally on board with bilingual
mm-hmm.
education, long before the Bilingual Education Act. That changes by the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
These Latino community papers are writing like headlines like, Lord Reagan cutting our
mm-hmm.
program. So that changes. And he certainly is attaining that status and that stature as kind of a conservative icon. Around sex education, it's really interesting. And I think to me speaks to the kind of much more national import of these programs. So after a few of these really intense fights, like the one that we just talked about in Anaheim, another one in San Mateo, lots of other ones as well,
right.
Governor Reagan says to Max Rafferty, who I mentioned, like, well, California is descending into moral decay.
Right.
This sex education thing is really bad. We need to do something about it. So he and Rafferty together appoint this moral guidelines committee. And they say, hey, guys, and they're mostly, well, they have some women on there, too, but they're mostly their appointees. And
mm-hmm.
they say, devise guidelines for teachers in the schools to teach our children morality, because we are in this moral nightmare right now. Oh, and by the way, remember that Supreme Court decision? Don't talk about God, right? So he appoints this committee, which gets, I mean, I couldn't believe the mail pouring in to this committee from all over the country. We're watching, we're rooting for you. Root out those, those hippies from our schools. Like, you need to be a leader. All over the country, people are watching this. What happens with that committee, actually, is that Reagan's pastor, Don Mumma, who he stayed fine with because he ended up presiding at one of the inaugurations, Don Mumma, who Reagan had appointed as a kind of conservative voice on that committee, actually ends up leading the liberal faction. And actually, what ends up happening, and this is part of my argument about how we've had actually this persistent kind of progressivism, is that even in this committee, which is stacked conservative, the conservatives come up with this long document, you know, against communism, against secular humanism, against the version of feminism that exists then. And then the Board of Education rejects it. They look it over and they say, no, we don't think so. They go back to the drawing board, the Moral Guidelines Committee. By now, they're in the early 1970s. Led by Don Mumma, who everyone thought was a conservative, but says, you know, we might actually be coming into new morality in the 1970s. He leads this liberal faction to come up with a version of these guidelines, which is also rooted in a kind of patriotism and a kind of nationalism, but is very different. It's much more in line with what we think of as progressive education today, saying America is wonderful. We must teach our children to be moral Americans, but that means helping us fulfill the promise we have not fulfilled yet, as evidenced by racism, sexism, all these things, right? That's a big deal and a big, huge switch. So Reagan's not happy about that, to say the least, right? But to get back to your point specifically about Reagan, these issues become central to the way he builds himself as a national candidate as well, right? And you see throughout the late 1960s and 70s in California that many of his rallying issues are precisely these kind of cultural issues. He says, I can't get people to stop talking about Berkeley and what's going on there, right? And he kind of deploys that very much as part of his persona of restoring a kind of, pre-1960s cultural landscape to the United States. And as we see, it's very successful. It, you know, makes him a conservative icon.
Right, absolutely. Well, I guess kind of moving towards the end of the book.
Yeah.
These ideas kind of come, I think, clashing together isn't the right word, but they've bubbled up together, and we get to a point where this sort of small, like the small government idea and sort of anti-tax, I think you use one of your headlines or one of your subheaders is like losing faith in the public schools, kind of converges where people are saying, okay, well, look, they're selling us this bilingual education that is really just a waste, or they're trying to have this sex education, which is wasting our tax dollars. And that kind of comes together as eventually Prop 13, but then it's just this idea that some failings within government and public institutions, really.
Absolutely. So during this period that I focused on in this book, from the kind of 60s to the late 70s and early 80s a little bit, one thing that you really have, which now seems almost quaint, is you have this kind of shared idea across the political spectrum that the public schools are worth fighting for, right? Mm. You have people of all different political stripes militating, Chicano radicals saying, we need Chicano administrators and we need different food in the cafeteria and we need different curriculum. You have Rafferty running for Senate on the platform of reading, writing, arithmetic, and Rafferty, right? So like not for the Senate, for the school board position, but this idea for the school superintendent position.
Right.
But you have this idea across the political spectrum, the public schools are worth fighting for no matter what. That starts to dissipate. Throughout the 1970s, I argue that on the one hand, you have, in some ways, the institutionalization of pretty progressive sex and bilingual education, which is not a story that we really know, right? But on the other hand, this mounting kind of resistance to it, one, inhibits the effectiveness of some of those programs for sure, but also begins to cultivate across the board also a kind of dissipating passion for what can be done in the public schools, a kind of loss of faith there. I mean, one flagrant example is Ernesto Galarza, who I mentioned, who was like your left-wing kind of progressive educator who gets so fed up with even the administration of the Bilingual Education Act that he's like, I'm done with this, right? Then on the other hand, you have less surprisingly all of these conservatives who go on to later champion much of like what we associate them with today, right? Kind of school choice vouchers. Yeah. There is a tax law that's passed in, I believe, 1978 that makes it easier to more financially easy to attend religious schooling during this period. So you have this kind of loss of faith in that regard generally. Prop 13, I think, is a really interesting kind of flashpoint to look at this. So Proposition 13, this major tax revolt in California in 1978, is almost always, in terms of education, positioned as having these unfortunate educational outcomes, right? So that Prop 13 was passed because people were sick of paying taxes for a variety of reasons. And, oh my gosh, the public schools were lost in the process. How did that happen? I argue, I think that, yes, I agree that that was an outcome, but that concern and loss of faith in the public schools was central to the success of that of the passage of that measure. And I draw on examples from, a lot of different places, but you see, especially around these issues, bilingual education, sex education, and a lot of kind of other progressive programs that dissatisfaction with the way that they have been executed leads to an unwillingness to finance these kind of programs. And among a broader swath of people than one might expect. These are not just avowed small government conservatives. And that to me is one of the most interesting kind of things that came out of this too, right? Is also knitting together these so-called cultural concerns with fiscal concerns. I mean, those are things are often, detached from one another by scholars or pundits who say like, distract the voters with these cultural issues and then they vote against their real economic concerns. Well, to me, that's a pretty condescending about the importance of cultural issues. Culture is real, right? And I think that this interpretation of Prop 13, which I offer, really shows in concrete ways how they're knitted together.
Yeah, absolutely. And, we, in this short conversation, we can't go over each detail, but I think this was a very nice sort of, table setting for those who are interested in further reading the book. I'm personally interested in we talked about it a little bit before the interview, but can you maybe just give a little bit of like, how do you go about find, are you archives, do your newspapers, like you have some beautiful quotes. I remember somebody said, I think it was sex education is more dangerous than the bomb, Vietnam, and all these other things, like this quote, these are great. Where do you get these? How do you put this together?
Lots of obsessive work, basically. Well, actually, so this research began as my dissertation research, which I completed my dissertation in 2009. So think that I've been researching this in some way for like 10 years, right? Now, in the course of those 10 years, so much has been digitized in a way that is actually beautiful, but that also I'm banging my head against the wall when I see some document that I spent hours pulling out of dusty things at great expense in 100-degree Sacramento weather, and now it's like Google it and it shows up, right? So now there's a lot of digital stuff that you can do, although I think real archives are really valuable because we will never digitize everything. But specifically, how did I go about finding archives? Well, one place to always start is just if you're at a university, I mean, the New York Times and the LA Times are archived historically on ProQuest. So for me, that was huge. Those are both kind of papers of record. So you can kind of start figuring out, like, what were people fighting about? What were the big issues here? And that's the kind of way to get your feet wet. Then once you kind of figure out, okay, well, what archival collections, like, how am I going to really bring something new to the table beyond what someone, kind of like Googling online could figure out? So then the real gem there is WorldCat, right? Which WorldCat collects all of the archival collections nationally, maybe even globally, I think it's globally. It collects all these archival collections. And there, for me, you kind of have to just get obsessed with searching all different kinds of terms, figuring it out, looking at the footnotes of scholars that have come before you and figuring out, okay, well, they had this one line about this one place, right? Let me go in and try and figure out, like, maybe that's going to be a big part of what I'm looking at. Does that person have papers or does that, And then also, it was interesting for some of the oral history I did. And this is right when these sort of networks were just getting started, and kind of probably around 2005 or so. This is fairly recent history. So I was looking to get in touch with people who had lived through this. Mm-hmm. So I went on, I don't even know if it exists anymore, but something called classmates.com, I think it was. And this was basically, this is like a pre-Facebook right. kind of way to get in touch with old classmates.
Right.
And I didn't lie about who I was, but I basically joined like the classes of 1968 in all these different high schools
right.
and said like, do you want to put your class into history? And then I connected with a whole bunch of people, of course, as a self-selected group.
Sure.
So I'm not doing a sort of longitudinal study based
right.
on that. But in terms of adding a little bit of that oral history voice to this,
yeah.
that was really useful. Then, you know, talking to people, I went to people that you don't even really expect. Like for some of these urban histories, like the local studies, I really wanted to just deep dive into the city at large at that period. Mm-hmm. Like, what did it feel like to live there, right?
Right?
So that meant paging through all this microfilm of papers, which are so far from any kind of paper of record,
right.
but saying like, oh, you had like mother-daughter beauty pageants every week there, and you had Sadie Hawkins Day dance, and there was an argument about like the Halloween parades. And like for me, that sort of began to give me a worldview of the world that I was entering, because you really, one of the things I'm trying to do with this book is say that, you know, educational history, which is a field I'm proud to be a part of, we have lots of single issue studies, and we have lots of kind of institutional studies mm-hmm. about schools or educational issues, but which are a little bit outside of the kind of larger mainstream of American political and cultural history.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a disservice to everybody. So what I wanted to do was kind of look at these educational issues as like, how are these embedded and creating and crucibles for our larger political culture? Well, the way to do that
right.
is to get your feet wet, more than your feet, dive headlong
right.
into these diverse sources, which might seem far afield from bilingual education or sex education, but which tell you what was it like. Like I spent all this time looking at like these like Spanish language marketing campaigns in San Francisco in the 70s. So I'm like, oh, that's kind of a big deal
right.
that they were marketing to this group as a kind of market segment, right?
Right.
So anyway, so that's sort of a long answer, but anything you can get your hands on
yeah.
is really, really useful to kind of start piecing together
yeah.
the world, because that's what we do as historians. It's sort of a luxury that we don't have. We have methodology, but we don't have methodology in that same rigid way as like a more, for example, quantitative social scientist
right,
might have.
Yeah.
Like we're trying to uncover some historical moment is a lot of our work, right?
Right?
And so to do that, you can be and have to be really resourceful and creative and drawing from many, many different things. And that's just so exciting.
Yeah,
to me.
That's fantastic.
Anyway.
I think that was a very nice and tight way of just describing probably years and years of
many years
of research and
yeah.
time of your life. So thank you for that.
Sure.
And kind of the final question that we have on the New Books Network, but can you kind of give us what's next? What are you working on? I know this just got done, but you know, as academics, it's always
the next
one gets done and then open the door to another.
Yeah, no, I'm actually very excited about this new project that I have. So the new project that I'm working on is a kind of history of the emergence of wellness culture in America since 1950. And so the idea behind that, and generally hopefully the subtitle will be something like Food, Fitness, and American Selfhood since 1950. Mm. So looking at the way, since the kind of birth of the so-called affluent society in the 1950s,
right.
the way Americans have spent more time and energy investing themselves in food and fitness pursuits. And with that, kind of building these ideal and quite exclusive versions of the American self, which are kind of racially, morally, regionally invested. And for me, so like specifically, what will that look like? Well, part of it, some of the things I want to look at, like on the fitness side, I'm really interested in the kind of mainstreaming of yoga culture in America, looking at the way that the kind of largely women's like group fitness craze of the 1980s, like what that
right.
really meant, right? I'm also interested in the democratization of so-called like race culture. And I say that not race as in, you know, the social construct, but like running races,
yeah.
right? Like how did it go from in 1966 when the book Jogging was published? It now seems like, why would you have to publish a book called Jogging, right?
Right.
But people didn't jog for fun. People didn't get on treadmills and
yeah.
gyms or anything like that. Now, like not everybody, but lots of people say, oh, I'm going to go run a 5K or I'm walking for the cure. And so to me, there's sort of interesting insights there about American community and individualism and capitalism and kind of a lot there. Similarly, on the food side, some of the issues I want to look at is the kind of rise of organic farming in the United States as a major kind of industry. then this might seem very different, but the kind of natural motherhood movement around like feeding natural foods, breastfeeding, etc. So to me, there's a lot in, I haven't quite parsed it out yet, but I'm working on it. And I got really interested in this in some ways, in part when I was researching Classroom Wars. You know, there I was looking at California in the 60s and 70s and kind of like the rise of like new age culture and like all of this kind of like, in many ways, anti-materialism that I was seeing in California as well. So that started to interest me. And then just in my own life, which had always been very distant from kind of my scholarly pursuits, I've been like sort of deep in this like mind body wellness thing, but also like critically observing, like, why now? Why has this become so popular? Why do people find this transformative? Why women? Why, you know? So to me, I'm working on bringing that all together in a new project, but that's the next stage, is how did wellness become this national kind of craze in the United States.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. I think there's definitely connections to this book as well. And we'll be certainly looking for that maybe
in the future.
Exactly. But I just want to let everyone know, thank you for listening. Thank you to Natalia Melman Petrozella. And I encourage you to go check out Classroom Wars, Language, Sex, and the Making of Modern Political Culture. Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and I hope you learned something.